Habsburg Empire, only too happy to give him a room with a view and 3 squares a day as he contemplated his writing block. Alone in his well-appointed room, taking in the magnificent view of the Adriatic. But never mind that feminist smirk, it came later. Besides poetry, I was studying typography and the handmade book as a grad student. I chose Rilke's line about those two loving solitudes as the first sentence I set, letter by metal letter, from the California job case. The big divided box filled with its sorts, as typographers call the tiny sculptural letters used to make up words. Composing stick in one hand, picking up tiny bits of molten lead with the other. I was learning to do pretty much what Gutenberg did when he set the first movable type. This method was how words made their way to press and paper for centuries, until very recently when the scribing of digital bits descended upon us and changed the speed of everything in our you've-got-mail culture. The earlier composing method was slow and created an aura of isolation. Just the words and me, one metal letter at a time, laid in the flat of my hand, line by meticulous line, as if even prose were poetry, lineated. You had to consider the spaces as well, as if silence were an essential aspect of language, which of course it is. I may have taken up my fascination with typography after I read that part of Virginia Woolf's mental health regime, devised by the uxorious Leonard Woolf after one of her ruinous breakdowns, was to learn to set type. Talk about two solitudes protecting each other, or at least one protecting the other. Leonard was right. Setting type by hand is calming. It's sanity-promoting detail work. This therapeutic hobby led to the founding of the Hogarth Press, its first volume, printed in 1917 on a little hand press set up on the Woolf dining room table, was composed of a story by Virginia and one by Leonard. The second book, which I longed to own, or at least hold in my hand, was published in an edition of 300 in 1918, the beautiful New Zealand short story Prelude by Catherine Mansfield, whose work, Virginia admitted in her diary, was the only writing she had ever envied. This typesetting, a solo, silent endeavor, rather like the obsessive knitting that was also a passion among that crowd of modernist writers that included D.H. Lawrence, a demon knitter, turned into the Hogarth Press, a major literary presence in the first half of the 20th century, and still a literary imprint. It started with a woman in danger of losing her mind, sequestered in the quiet of a suburban London house, holding a composing stick, as if palming sanity, silently stacking up metal letters to make a line of sense. This is where we get that psycho-literary term, when we speak of someone being out of sorts. It's a typesetting term. Being out of sorts for a typesetter means not having enough letters, sorts, in your job case. Perhaps having used up all the P's or Q's, so you cannot compose the word you need. Watching your P's and Q's, another typesetting metaphor, the two metal bits easy to mistake in the job case. Virginia Woolf was sorting herself out. It worked for a while. Quite a while, really. She was alone not only with words, but with their steely components, individual letters. Literary sanity was there. She held it in her thin hand. "I want to be alone," my mother used to say distractedly, invoking Greta Garbo when we were making too much havoc at home. In fact, Garbo had not said she wanted to be alone. She said, "I want to be let alone." But in our own speedy culture, the distinction between the two statements, even for someone not savaged by celebrity, has been conflated. "Hurry, hurry." We have all turned into the white rabbit, and we're very late for a very important date. Though most of the time we can't say what it is. For us, I want to be alone means I want to be off the grid, no iPhone, no email, the 24/7 connectivity of our lot. I want to be let alone to be alone. No wonder that to a writer, to readers, to so many beset people now, solitude suggests not loneliness, but serenity, that kissing cousin of sanity. We speak of being alone to recharge our batteries. Even in our reach for solitude, we seem unable to unplug from the metaphor of our connectivity. Yet here's the greater paradox. Writing, though performed alone, starting in the dark of the mind, is also the only absolutely declarative, meaning-beset art form we have, and its purpose is to communicate with others. More than a painter, much more than a composer, a writer can never be alone. Our very medium is held in common. The language we are born into or adopt, Conrad, Nabokov, Alexander Hemin, from their Slavic languages into English, Milan Kundera, from Czech to French, most recently, Jhumpa Lahiri, from English to Italian. Language is a shared resource, not individual, not unique, not self-made. We are crowded on all sides with words we hold in common, words that mean the same thing to all of us. We get huffy about grammar. We fight over usage. Language is not, like paint, a medium. It is a system, another system. The ladies with theirs, Gregor Mendel quietly seeking the inner system of generation, the monks spinning the wheel of the cycle of psalms. Language is the ultimate system. We all use those same 26 letters. This is why Gutenberg's invention of movable type works at all. It is also why people will blithely say to a writer who has spent 6 or 8 years sweating out a work of fiction, "You know, if I had the time, I'd write a novel too." Not something a music lover is likely to tell a composer, "If I had the time, I'd write a symphony." We know we all own this thing, this habit of naming, expressing, connecting the narrative dots, the jabber that is our human signifier. I can talk, therefore I can write, if I had the time, if I bothered. In spite of everything I know about how hard it is to write, I can't say I really have an argument against that presumption. You could write this book if you had the time, if you even cared to. I find it hard to disbelieve this. But the paradox of a writer's relation to being alone, and specifically being alone with words, is even deeper than the fact that writing is communication. A writer is aware not only of her own voice humming along, but hears with the ear of that mysterious other, the elusive reader for whom the sentences are laid out. Writers are always, always in relationship. We write to, for the reader, which is more confounding, really, than having, as actors do, an audience that is a distanced and objectified, congregated other. Writers are caught, how else to put this, in an embrace. They, we, I, cannot escape from communicating. Even so-called and self-defined experimental writers who appear not to care about the reader or even disdain him underscore even more powerfully in their refusal to play nicely with others the frustrations of the chaotic self in its struggle with that most shared and social of materials, language. Yes, Samuel Beckett, Mr. Minimal, said of his work, "In my life, since we must call it so, There were three things: the inability to speak, the inability to be silent, and solitude. That's what I've had to make the best of. My life, since we must call it so. Beckett would really rather not have his three attributes gathered into anything as repellently autobiographical as my life. Yet there it is. A writer is composed, perhaps, of equal parts of silence, articulation, and isolation. That's the job. That's the life. We do not, in the act of composition, have an audience. We have a reader. The writer is the mouth, the reader the ear. The body is language, and it is shared. We write to a singular other whom we must allure, embrace, enchant. We are whispering into that singular shell-shaped ear. This is probably inevitable, for our first literary experience is not as a writer, but as a reader. We read as individuals, and as writers, we write not for readers in a collective sense, but for what earlier generations frankly called the dear reader. It's a crazy love affair, this murmuring into the ear of the elusive yet intimate mystery person. Being so intimate, of course, it has to be done in private, in the solitude of the lonely mind. True, there is a performance aspect to it all. We give readings, separating the private act of composition from the act of sharing the work. But that is after the act of composition is over and done, rather like trotting out your precocious 5-year-old to the audience, never thinking to present the act of conception to the crowd. When you give a reading in a large, full hall, a genuine theater, the audience is entirely in the dark, you, the solo spotlighted figure. You can't see them, and they're very quiet out there. You might even jump to hear that weird beast let out its communal ha-ha as something funny you've read to them, to it. You are so alone up there, you forget they have been gathered into an audience. Nothing could be further from the dear reader you were writing to in your room. In the act of writing, the writer is never really alone, even though being alone is the one thing we recognize as our chance for authenticity, for surprising ourselves out of predictability, for thinking. Even writing a diary, Virginia Woolf cannily noted, is not the act of solitude it might seem. We all like to look good to ourselves, even in that privacy. We are our own, dear reader. Solitude provides the illusion, or is it the reality, of a self. If I'm alone, I can think dark thoughts, be real, be phony, try this, try that, erase, contradict, forge ahead, double back. We all contain multitudes, not just Whitman, not just Montaigne, that master of contradiction. The longing for solitude is a deeply romantic passion. But then, writing is a romantic thing to do, predicated on desire, urgency, and an ideal of human connection hardly available in what we wistfully call real life. Maybe especially when we are not living alone, when circumstances deny privacy, not to mention solitude, when we are very much in the midst of the demands of family or job, whatever it is that outlaws solitude. Perhaps it is especially then we are most in love with what solitude seems to provide, what it promises. It promises freedom. To be alone is to be free. Who said that? It's an idea floating around, said by many. But I'm thinking of Julian Barnes in Levels of Life, his memoir of his wife's untimely death from a brain tumor. He quotes a widowed friend who admits that even in her terrible grief, she also realizes she is free. Free of what? Free for what? In his book, Barnes performs what might be called a tour of bereavement, that is, enforced solitude. He does not feel free, as his widowed friend admits to feeling. Wisely, he does not see her admission as the absence of grief, but as an aspect of her particular grief. Grief is the unbearable inverse of resonant solitude. It is solitary confinement, now recognized by the Human Rights Commission as torture. Barnes says he cannot be in crowds. They remind him of his isolation. Or Mary Shelley's response to her husband's death. Solitude was my only consolation. Deep, dark, death-like solitude. Or as a recently widowed neighbor of mine said, sheepishly, I just want to stay in my hidey hole. To be denied the beloved, it turns out, is to be denied oneself. I love living with you. It's like being alone. That is the radiant paradox of aloneness connection that a writer, forget a writer, a person, must find within, whether beset with children, with the care of elderly withering parents, stuck with a hopeless spouse, with a soul-sapping job, or just burdened with a killer to-do list. We must learn to be alone in the midst of whatever denies us useful solitude. We must make up solitude where it does not exist. Here you are again, coming to my aid, proving once again the reader, not the writer, has the keenest bead on the work. This time it is the voice of a dying man. We were visiting. Death didn't come into it. You weren't expected to die. Not yet. Sometime. But not anytime soon. You're only a dying man in retrospect. You like to sit in the kitchen. That's where we were. You said you'd like a cup of coffee, and would I make it strong, please? With my back turned from you to your much-prized coffee maker, you said, apropos of nothing, in a voice not personal, but decisive, quiet, calm, you must always keep a part of your mind entirely to yourself. You weren't speaking generally, saying one should do this. You spoke directly to me, to the back of my head, as if to the base of my existence. The voice of an oracle, a message like the one at the core of Western civilization, know thyself. You repeated it, as if it had to be posted twice. You must always keep a part of your mind entirely to yourself. Said mere days before your unexpected death, an odd, disconnected remark. Not part of the conversation we were having. We were talking about the dog who stood between us and seemed to be listening. You were speaking of the absolute requirement of solitude, not outside oneself, as I had been on retreat in California. This was the solitude within the mind. This is integrity. I was measuring the coffee into the coffee maker. I didn't turn around. I don't think you would have said it if I'd been facing you. You had to speak to the back of my head. It wasn't something to talk about across the yellow table. An oracle is like that, distant, implacable, penetrating. I added the water, listened to the thing bubbling. I understood you were saying something essential, even though it was off the cuff. You were speaking. How strange I didn't realize it then, from a position almost on the other side of this surface we call life. Maybe I did sense that. Solitude itself was speaking to me. I've come upon yet another example of solitude from Virginia Woolf, that writing virago who went from novels to essays, to diary, on to letters, cycling back into fiction and nonfiction, an endless round of sentences for something like 40 years. It sometimes seems wearyingly that she said just about everything a person could say about the life of the mind. She was aware that she and her contemporaries at the dawn of what we call modernism were breaking with narrative tradition at some cost. She says about this new kind of writing that describes not the surface of action, but the pulse of thought. I have to create the whole thing afresh for myself each time. Probably all writers now are in the same boat. It is the penalty we pay for breaking with tradition, and the solitude makes the writing more exciting. Perhaps inevitably she latches onto our word, solitude. It is an oddly personal word to describe the penalty of breaking with tradition. She is describing a cultural separation, but one she experiences in bruising personal terms. And notice, the solitude makes the writing more exciting. Wolfe was fretting, also preening, that this new narration of inner consciousness, her task, her break with tradition, was something quite different, more coolly detached than writing her life. To write her mind, she was entering a solitude not romantic, but planetary. It was not autobiographical. She makes clear that this solitude is not about delving into the self. She even suggests a practical method to attain this solitude. The first step, she says, is gentle exercise in the air. This is not a metaphor. She means go for a walk. Walk. Let the world and the elements have at you. Second, the reading of good literature. It is a mistake, she says, to think that literature can be produced from the raw. That is, from the solo self, from inside. Solitude is not a matter of consciously searching for originality of the unique self. The opposite. The first step is physical exercise. The second is reading. Not writing, but reading. Getting into somebody else's head. Curiously, the purpose she finds in solitude, or perhaps its lesson, is not to be alone with oneself. Solitude is not about discovering one's genius, one's misery or glory, one's anything. Not even one's life. Beckett's My Life, since we must call it so. Rather, she says in this diary entry, one must become externalized, very, very concentrated. Not having to draw upon the scattered parts of one's character, living in the brain. Get over yourself, in other words. This isn't about you. See yourself not as a source, not even as a subject, but as an instrument. Montaigne's discovery in the essay. This liberation from the ego is the purpose of solitude, to hone the blade of the self, to cut into reality, to bring a jagged piece of it back, a shard. Don't expect to get the whole thing, the grail called form. You get maybe a shard. Put it in your pocket. Keep walking in the open air. It sounds lonely, but there is nothing to be afraid of here, apparently. The cure for loneliness, Marianne Moore advised, is solitude. What she is saying in her gnomic way is that loneliness is self-regarding, while solitude is world-regarding. Loneliness eats away at you. Solitude fills and fills you. The testimony of contemplatives makes this clear. Hermits and cloistered nuns and monks who leave the world in order to think of and pray about nothing else but the world and its suffering. A failed monk is a monk trying to save himself. The point of solitude for these professional solitaries is not to save their souls, but to take on the reality of the world. That reality. I'm only reporting here. See Buddha. See John of the Cross. See Simone Weil. Displays the fundamental facts of affliction and beauty. Both. the poles of existence, the thorn and the rose. To do this work, as the dying man told me, asking me to refill his coffee, you liked it black in the little white mug, is that a part of the mind must be kept separate. Be still and know that I am God, as the psalmist says of the apprehension of reality. Then there is Blaise Pascal with his lemon-sucking aphorism. All of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Really? If we're going to think about sitting quietly in a room alone, I'd rather think about Emily Dickinson, the white dresses, the upright house with the fence around it, the dense, dark cakes given to neighbors, tiny poems in her spider hand on the bits of paper in the backs of envelopes, the snatches of reality she managed to cage like crickets chirping in bamboo boxes. She took on the subject of solitude, too, understanding it as cosmic, not personal. Though to know and express that fact, you have to become remote yourself, like a moon, cold and distant upon which reality is reflected. You have to keep part of your mind to yourself, separate, as you said, hands around your hot coffee mug. She figured out how to do that. This is her solitude poem. Here is a solitude of space, a solitude of sea, a solitude of death, but these society shall be, compared with that profounder sight, that polar privacy, a soul admitted to itself. Finite infinity. There's a woman who has sat in her room alone and only allowed words in as her company. It's a much bigger condition than avoiding the troubles of the world. It is more like braving the troubles, shouldering them. Take a walk in the open air, Pascal. Thinking so long about solitude, I have arrived at poetry, of course, because poetry sets the campfire for solitude. My first love, and yours too, poems. The telltale shelves of the narrow paperbacks of contemporary poets that first day when you invited me in for a cup of coffee after showing me the garbage bins. And I have arrived at mother and father, Emily, and now Walt, that hugger-mugger working the room, hardly a poet we think of as a solitude man. But perhaps his thoughts about solitude are even truer to our condition as people who are not monks, but who long for love and for the privacy of mind. Here's Whitman's great solitude poem. I saw in Louisiana a live oak growing. All alone stood it, and the moss hung down from the branches. Without any companion, it grew there, uttering joyous leaves of dark green, and its look, rude, unbending, lusty, made me think of myself. But I wondered how it could utter joyous leaves standing alone there, without its friend, its lover, near, for I knew I could not. And I broke off a twig with a certain number of leaves upon it, and twined around it a little moss, and brought it away, and I have placed it in sight in my room. It is not needed to remind me, as of my own dear friends, for I believe lately I think of little else than of them. Yet it remains to me a curious token. It makes me think of manly love. For all that, and though the live oak glistens there in Louisiana, solitary in a wide, flat space, uttering joyous leaves all its life, without a friend, a lover near, I know very well I could not. There is a reading of this poem, current today, that sees it principally as a testament of sexual love, as surely it is. But it is also a poem of solitude, and has about it some of the urgency I felt in that Rilke line all those years ago, a love that consists in this, that two solitudes protect and touch and greet each other. There is always this paradox in great passion, the desire to merge, or at least to be companioned, and the desire to be solitary, singular. The writer's dilemma, and the lover's. Emily Dickinson's poem is more serene, more abstract than Whitman's. She speaks of the human condition as a contemplative, he of the human plight as a lover. Solitude is fine, as Balzac said, but you need someone to tell that solitude is fine. This is where being a writer comes in. Solitude is fine, but we need to tell the page, the screen, the reader, that it is. Dickinson may not have needed the reader. Whitman panted after him. Like Beckett, we are beset with the inability to speak, with the inability to be silent here in our solitude. But what, after all, is this solitude? What is it besides being alone? Kafka, always good for ratcheting up the misery quotient, said, "I need solitude for my writing, not like a hermit. That wouldn't be enough, but like a dead man." And wasn't it a man almost dead who said to me, holding the warmth of his coffee mug, speaking out of nowhere except from the need to say something essential before he would speak no more, "You need to keep a part of your mind always to yourself." And what would that mean? If essential solitude is keeping a part of your mind always to yourself, what does that look like, feel like? What does it do to and for a writer? No, for anyone. We're in this together, reader, writer. I find myself reaching back to the first contemporary poem I loved, a poem whose simplicity overwhelmed me. It's the first poem I taught to a group of students when I was hardly older than they, in my hot little miniskirt and fry boots at the University of Iowa in 1968. I have never stopped loving this poem, but I may only have begun to understand it. Maybe. It is such a simple poem. I put it on our bedroom wall, and I have it by heart as we speak of memorization. James writes, "Lying in a hammock at William Duffy's farm in Pine Island, Minnesota. Over my head, I see the bronze butterfly asleep on the black trunk, blowing like a leaf in green shadow. Down the ravine behind the empty house, the cowbells follow one another into the distances of the afternoon. To my right, in a field of sunlight between two pines, the droppings of last year's horses blaze up like golden stones. I lean back as the evening darkens and comes on. A chicken hawk floats over, looking for home. I have wasted my life." It was only many years after first reading it that I discovered Wright's final line, "I have wasted my life," is a steal from or homage to Rilke's poem, "Archaic Torso of Apollo." Rilke's poem is also built as a description, in his case, of a fragment of a Greek statue. Wright knew Rilke's poem in the original German and must have been dazzled by the startling final line that seems to have no logical or even associative connection with the poem's description. After taking three stanzas to describe the statue in all its detail, Rilke ends with the stern, unexplained finale, "You must change your life." When I discovered the Rilke poem much later, it seemed to me that it had been influenced by Wright, not the other way round. It was Wright's poem that riveted me, describing a landscape I knew intimately, the landscape of my flyover estate, a town barely an hour from my hometown. Just to see its name in a book of poetry thrilled me. Pine Island. Imagine, in a poem. And then years later, you and I drove past Pine Island time and again on the freeway to the Mayo Clinic, that Lourdes we visited so faithfully, for a while a place of miracles. Wright's poem bedeviled me for years. At first I thought the final line was a statement of defeat. It seemed brave, if sad. Some years later, I felt smart and considerably more literary when I decided, no, I have wasted my life as a cry of triumph. I'm lying here in this hammock doing nothing, and ha-ha on you out there working your lives away. I have the nerve to waste my life. Much later still, very much later, with various betrayals and deaths and my own failures behind me and yet ever before me, I realized that Wright was attesting to failure, but a very different failure than I had understood as a young poet enthralled with the idea of solitude and afraid of the life of love. Here's how I've come to understand this apparently simple poem. Lying in the hammock, the poet is alone, empty-minded. That is, he is living in solitude, the solitude of his mind. The world in its homely detail, sleeping butterfly, horse droppings, enters this solitude that is his consciousness. He realizes this has never happened to him before. He has never truly seen the world, its reality and detail. He is stunned to realize this. He has wasted his life precisely because he sees he has not wasted his life enough, or really at all. Until this moment. That was his mistake. He has not failed, as I thought as a girl first reading the poem, imagining the defeat was that he was just describing a butterfly, a wizened horse turd, a this, a that. I thought he was ashamed of his aimlessness, that he was valiantly articulating his failure. Nor did I understand the poem when I read it again in the ambition of my own first poems, when I thought he was thumbing his arty nose at all the worker bees out there, that he was proudly claiming to be a free spirit who doesn't labor and glories in lying around all day. He was a vainglorious lily of the field. All wrong, I see now. He was acknowledging the waste of his life, that is, of his mind. But not for the reason I had thought. Rather, that final line, I have wasted my life, is suffused with wonder, the wonder of revelation that his experience in the hammock has given him. He is finally wasting his life. It's a conversion moment, I suppose, an exultant aha. He sees that this emptiness of self, that this alone makes a life worth living, a life worth writing. He has been rinsed of ambition, of pride in himself, rinsed of shame over his failures, emptied of his grudges. He has even let go of time, of history, the sources of our regret, our sense that we have done it all wrong. Once reality has stabbed you in the heart like this, you are indeed free. Or when that sweet pain does leave you, Montaigne got that so right. It's about portraying passing. The realization remains, a sure memory. This realization, not your ego, is your true self. Alone, outside time, but paradoxically within the moment. There he is, a poet suspended on planet Earth, in that most ephemeral piece of furniture, the hammock, swinging in the eternity of the moment, and he is empty of himself at last. The whole world rushes in. It's wildly ordinary, this moment of horse dung and cowbells, and it's beautiful. And he can write it because, as the dying man advised, your last intelligence debriefed in the kitchen, holding the warm coffee mug I had handed you. His mind is separate. It rests in the solitude that opens, finally, fully, to the world. Is that what you were saying, darling? My face turned away. Your voice coming to me from the other side you were approaching. The dog has curled up on the dark navy back deck cushion, her place. And the coffee theme advances, this time my hand holding one of the blue willow cups we bought in that Prairie du Chien secondhand store, a whole set for the boat, because you had read that it was the pattern used on riverboats in the 19th century. I still come down here, sit, read, stare out at the river as the barges go by this scruffy city marina tucked under the high bridge. We never thought of mooring the boat out of the city on the prettier, people say, St. Croix. We wanted a working river, wanted to be at the Mississippi headwaters, the beginning of the great waterway to the sea. The barges drift along in their stately way, nudged forth by chubby workboats called tows or tugs, though in fact they push the barges from behind, no tugging or towing involved. We remarked on that, our usual preoccupation with words, words. Must look that up, you said. Why they're towboats, not pushboats. Never got around to that. It's a ragged 1940 Christcraft cabin cruiser, a Woody you bought while we were courting, that antique term you used. It was as if you'd tossed an old Steinway in the water. You'd always wanted a boat. A Kansas boy, long in love with water. You're elsewhere. But you got the Christcraft, you told me later, to romance me. After a whirlwind courtship of 8 years, you like to say, we got married. But really, you had me at the garbage bins the day I moved into the apartment above yours. The boat has a deco look, as if Bogart might step out of the main saloon with a shaker of martinis. A boat just big enough, 33 feet, for us to pretend it was a cottage. Back deck like a little porch where I sit looking out. The mahogany saloon outfitted with chairs, table, the chrome-fitted steering wheel, windows that roll down like car windows. Then a few steps down to the tiny galley, starboard side. And, tinier still, the head, port side. Forward, the jewel box of the V-berth, our nest. A round hatch at the top of the silky white-painted chamber, fitted with a screen. Nights when we had to scramble to pull down the hatch when it rained. That we loved. Rain tapping on the little wooden craft. Our legs twined under the cloud of the marine blue duvet. Thunder. Lightning. Curled up together in the chamber of wood. As if within a perfectly tuned musical instrument. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing, Rat informs Mole in The Wind and the Willows, as simply messing about in boats. He speaks with the domestic satisfaction of the householder, not the adventure voice of the seafarer. Cabin cruisers and houseboats play a watery riff on the art of housekeeping. Mornings we climbed onto the forward deck with a can of Brasso to polish the chrome fittings, the boat bobbing like a well-rocked cradle in the marina slip. Not to mention your fiddling below deck with the engine, the generator, the bilge pumps. This marine house cleaning is not to be confused with dusting the dining room chairs or vacuuming the rug at home. It's messing about in boats. It's domestic romance. Whole seasons can go by, and did, in a round of such fantasy housekeeping, interrupted by picnic rides out of the marina up to the confluence of the Mississippi and the Minnesota rivers, one dark steel, the other golden brown, past Fort Snelling, high on the bluff. The fact of the sprawling metropolitan area erased as we drifted by stands of oak, past a heron rookery, a tangle of old cottonwood roots exposed in the mud. The boat returned contentedly to the slip like a nag glad to regain her stall. Not to mention, though I want to mention all of it, all those years, the sheer dreamy frittering of time, sitting on the back deck reading to the end of Villette, one of those fat novels I always meant to finish, getting up to make coffee in the marine spruce galley, a rare place for everything, everything in its place, place. At twilight, the plush, emerald-headed mallards moved from boat to boat along the little community marina where some of the boats were year-round homes for live-aboards, and we stood on the back deck, tossing bits of bread into the water. The long afternoon swooned into night, and it was time to switch on the radio, catch the twins losing again as the dark water sent up gleaming reflections from the city lights. A soft bobbing, like a riverine heartbeat, whenever a barge passed by, shedding faint waves toward shore. "That's the charm of it," Rat explains. "You're always busy, and you never do anything in particular." We talked for years about taking a big trip downriver. We had the river, we had the boat, frail old craft that she was. We seemed only to lack the gumption. Where to go? New Orleans? Too ambitious. St. Louis? Still too far, and word in the marina was that the best scenery on the river was our own, the upper Mississippi above Dubuque. We settled finally on Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, as our destination, about 200 miles south of St. Paul, an easy day trip by car. But with our sedate Hercules Flathead 6 engine, rebuilt, conducting herself like a Dowager Royal, we only made 10 miles an hour tops, going with the current, considerably less on the upriver return. 2 weeks, down and back up. Doable. Prairie du Chien had another appeal. There, at the mouth of the Wisconsin River, the veteran voyageur Louis Joliet, along with Père Jacques Marquette, a Jesuit trained as a cartographer and fluent in several Indian languages, canoed with their Indian guides down the Fox and Wisconsin rivers from their raw station of St. Ignace and arrived finally on June 17, 1673, at their long-imagined destination, the Mississippi. Marquette's diary notation is the first European record of an encounter with the river. "We were traveling not simply to a place, but to a point in history. We studied the guidebooks and river charts. Think we can make Red Wing in a day?" we wondered, speaking with real worry about a town barely an hour away by car. We decided to take 2 days. Better not chance it. By the time we departed in mid-July, when we spoke of going to Prairie du Chien, we sounded as if we were embarking for Cathay. The charts were littered with the names of landings and sloughs without road access or populations, places long forgotten or never settled, abandoned except by the agate type of the river charts. Winter's Landing, Coon Middle Daymark, Ruby Ferry Light, Bad Axe Island, Betsy Slough and Millstone Landing, Canton Chute, Winfield Access, Shady Creek, and my favorite, Point, No Point. Reading these names gave presence to anonymous and unmarked islands, the sandy or forested riverbanks we passed. The absence of habitation attached to a place name made the very real landscape somehow an imaginative construct. Point, No Point, indeed. The river pooled and spread, opening at sudden turns into inlets and back channels where we could not go. Only shallow draft boats, canoes, and john boats could explore those mysterious byways. We held to the channel, 9 feet deep, that the Corps of Engineers had dredged for the tows, a public works project dating from the Depression, looking off to the named places hidden and somehow imaginary existing only in the words given them on the charts. The tidy, canal-like channel of the river we knew in downtown St. Paul gave way to an island-studded relay of industrial parks and generous suburban lots, the riverside's heavy with parked barges, and finally, a sewage plant up against a heron rookery, one of the major bird sanctuaries on the Great Mississippi Flyway. White egrets refined as Egyptian ibis streaked over the water, landing their minimal forms on the gray, bleached driftwood lying in the shallows, composed together like a collection of Brancusi sculptures. We followed the channel, obeying the markers, as the river opened up, threading our course around uninhabited islands, keeping the illusion we were moving on a straight and narrow waterway. But even as we kept thinking of the river as a line running down the middle of the country, it revealed itself as a massive conspiracy of waterways, a feuding, feeding clan of intermarried streams and related watercourses, perfectly capable of spilling over almost a third of the American landmass at its heart, as it had in the historic floods of 1993, when we were still treating the boat as a cabin, sitting snug in our marina slip. Left to its own devices, if ever that was, even the Ojibwe made dams and rudimentary fordings. The upper Midwest is a vast wetland. At our center, we are not the heartland, but islands adrift in a waterland. Individualism not simply an American idea, but a fact of our geography. Our trip was punctuated by brief dramas of locking through the nine locks between St. Paul and Prairie du Chien. You were pretty convincing at the wheel, your face still and steady, pulling the grand piano we had unwisely set afloat right up to the side of the wet, mossy cement lock wall. I lurched around, madly grabbing for the line the lock keeper slung down. But these were frantic interludes in the long, dreamy progress through a landscape that became increasingly improbable, beautiful, sublime in a way the Midwest is not supposed to be. Gone the farmlands and prairies, gone the featureless flyover I had fretted against all my girlhood and beyond. The modesty and long horizons of the Midwest's usual rural charms, never charming to me, looking for the great world, my real estate searches for chateaus and seaside cottages in Brittany. All this usual expectation and assumption about the landscape gave way between Red Wing and La Crosse to high romantic vistas, arrays of sheer-faced palisades and bluffs that effectively erased the dairy farms, the corn and bean fields that lay beyond them. The whole length of the trip, we saw only one silo, set high in the distance like a campanile. "Move over, castles on the Rhine," you said as we passed Trempolo on the Wisconsin side. We were not in the pioneer farmscape of the 19th century, but further back to the terrain of the French and Indian hunters and traders, the explorers of the 17th century, almost back to Montaigne's homme simple et grossier, his simple, crude fellow who could report to him on the creatures of the new world, the men living naked and free. Nowhere does the Midwest feel as ancient or as unmarked, even with the intrusion of the locks and dams. To experience this time travel, the dislocation of history, we had to be on the river. We had taken the same trip many times by car, down the Minnesota side, up the Wisconsin side. But never these views, the theatrical palisades obscuring with a tease and then revealing a whole panorama of interlocked channels and inlets, even grander bluffs plunging into the river as the boat rounded an island curve. Somewhere there were bean fields. Somewhere, apple orchards, dairy farms, and all that cheese. But here, low down in the channel, the passage was caught in the older drift, of history and the memory of bark canoes. The camaraderie of real travel, of those meeting off the beaten trail and needing the kindness of strangers, was ours too. From Prescott, our first stop, all the way to Prairie du Chien, the marinas where we rented a slip each night proved to be worlds of their own, transient communities with the easy friendliness of campgrounds. At Prescott, the marina owner gave us a bag of charcoal so we could use the grill in the town park pitched above the river. I stood on the grassy rise, glass of wine in hand, turning the chicken, gazing out at the confluence where the deep blue ribbon of the St. Croix cuts into the golden brown of the Mississippi. Next to the grill, a bronze plaque marked the place. In 1680, explorers Hennepin and Duluth passed this point. The bag of charcoal was not the only kindness offered by strangers. At every marina, people jumped off their boats to help us land and cast off, emerging from their houseboats, then drifting courteously away again. In La Crosse, we walked from our slip at Pettibone Marina along the highway in the dark, until we arrived at a convenience store office of a campground that had a laundromat. While we were paying for a carton of milk, we mentioned to the owner of the place, a tired-looking man who must have put in a long day, that we were docked at Pettibone and had walked over. "Too bad we hadn't known about the laundromat," I said. "Hard to find places to do laundry on the river." "Here," he said, and handed over his car keys. "Drive over to Pettibone and bring your laundry over to wash." He wouldn't take our driver's licenses, didn't even glance at them as we tried to push them on him as collateral. We climbed into his Chrysler, the radio tuned to the C&W station, and headed back to the marina. I realized I was clutching the sides of the car seat on the highway as you drove. Cars, everything, seemed to be going so fast. It felt mad. I was glad, you said you were too, relieved really, to return the Chrysler to the trusting man, do the laundry, walk back to the boat with our clean clothes folded and stowed in our backpacks. We were glad to be walking, restored to the sanity of river time, river speed. The towns on the Wisconsin side, from Maiden Rock and Stockholm, past Pepin and Alma, were charming hamlets, their rough brick buildings cast at river's edge against the swelling bluffs and magnificent heights that rose behind them. We got halfway across Lake Pepin, the big bulge in the river, too far to turn back to Red Wing, still distant from Wabasha at the lower tip, when the Coast Guard station came on the marine radio with a tornado warning. The sky, which had been pastel, looked suddenly bruised and angry. There was nothing to do but follow the channel, fingers crossed. Your face a mask of calm, but I could read you, alarm in your hazel eyes. Luck was with us. The tornado dematerialized. We spent the night in a state of grateful reprieve, rocking under the tin-covered slip at the Wabasha Marina, the rain making pinging sounds on the corrugated roof as the barn swallows flew in and out. We lay in the cuddy cabin, looking out the round hatch, at nothing, I thought, when a great blue heron sailed by, its flight caught in the frame of the hatch as if in the lens of a camera. An instant. Boats, tethered to the creaking wooden slips, rubbed against their bumpers, sighing and groaning like well-fed beasts. Wabasha was our favorite marina. I was swapping out chateaus for boat slips. "Let's bring the boat down here next year for the whole summer." Your laconic reply from the helm. "We could." But Fountain City and Trempealeau, farther south, were our favorite towns. Sweet old villages, their grandeur well behind them, but their locations a lasting reward, nestled below palisades where the river spread like a great creased cloak thrown before them in permanent homage. Wouldn't it be great, I said, as we headed toward the municipal dock? There was no marina. If Fountain City had a soda fountain? For once,